Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by the Plan B Network and Bitbox. This is the course on Bitcoin sovereignty through mathematics. I'm Knut Swanholm, and I'm here, as always, with Luke DeWolf. Good morning, Luke. How are you today?
Good morning, Knut. I'm great. And this is a great chapter, so I'm excited. It's quite relevant to lots of things going on, Bitcoin mining, plenty of other things. It's called The Environment. This will be interesting.
Yeah. I first started writing about Bitcoin and the environment back in 2017, I think. So there's an old article where I start talking about this, things that we see play out right now in terms of like people connecting Bitcoin mining rigs to renewable energy sources and thereby finding a way to monetize excess energy. We'll get into all of that in this chapter, and looking forward to it.
Absolutely great. So just before we dive in, just a reminder, the best way you can support this initiative and get involved is to join the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, and the best way you can do that is to go to our Geyser page at geyser.fund/project/infinity. You can get all the information about what we're doing. And you can get involved, join the academy, join one of the courses, maybe even pick up the Mithril Adamantium membership, which is as exciting as it sounds. And yeah, join us for the recordings, get involved with the discussion, all of that. We're really enjoying how this Bitcoin Infinity Academy has been going, and we want you to come along. So you can do that if you like. Knut, anything else to mention before we start?
I don't think so. You can get on with the narration.
Perfect. Let's get to it then. The environment. There's no such thing as a free lunch. There's no such thing as a zero-sum game. The second law of thermodynamics tells us this. You know, the one about entropy and how everything will be really lame in a couple of trillion years. There's no action without an equally big reaction somewhere. This is also true for Bitcoin mining. Every once in a while, some ignorant, clickbait-hungry journalist writes an article about Bitcoin's energy usage and how it's connected to global warming, or how widespread Bitcoin adoption would kill us all someday because of its wasteful production process. What they all fail to address is the alternative cost. As mentioned before, Bitcoin is valuable because it's scarce, and it's scarce because it's costly to produce. The same is true for gold or diamonds or anything else that is scarce and hard to come by. As discussed in earlier chapters, the mining algorithm can never be any more energy efficient because the electricity spent is directly linked to the value of the token. Secondly, think about what most people use their Bitcoin for. Nothing. That's right, nothing. Bitcoin incentivizes saving rather than spending. This is the exact opposite of how people use money in our current system of fiat currencies, because Bitcoin is deflationary rather than inflationary, rather to all other currencies. This means that every dollar, yen, or pound spent on Bitcoin would have ended up being spent on some other energy-demanding thing had it not been spent on Bitcoin. Either that, or it would have lost its value due to inflation, which implies that even more dollars, yen, or euros would have been created and spent on frivolous things. Right now, credit is cheap, and the underlying economic theory of our time is based on the idea that the amount of spending going on in society is a key metric in economics. Bitcoin, on the other hand, is based on the economic theories of the Austrian school, where saving is the key metric. Yes, Bitcoin is costly to produce, but so is overproducing every product on Earth because every business needs to expand as fast as possible to pay off their loans. Human well-being has always been, and always will be, linearly connected to energy consumption. You can't get around or bypass this fact. Energy consumption and human flourishing are inevitably linked. The thing Bitcoin does is to take away the need for unnecessary energy consumption by incentivizing us to save for future generations. It's a mechanism that hinders our self-destructive tendencies. Not a threat to our planet's health, but a remedy. Yeah, a big couple of paragraphs here, but I think it was important to cover them both together. This is about Bitcoin mining, energy, how it relates to the environment, the world, lots of big topics. Can you get into this for us, Knut?
Yeah, there's a lot in here, and this is written back in 2019, so I might have put this differently if I wrote it today, this is sort of spilling the beans of the big one in the first two paragraphs here, and that is how sound money is just more friendly to everything than inflationary money, and that's the biggest environmental perk to Bitcoin. So like the thing is, when you have money that makes people prioritize quality over quantity, you get and adopt a lower time preference because it's not being inflated away, then you get the misallocation of resources goes away. So resources are you know, distributed among the through the economy in more efficient ways. So this is about energy efficiency, really, and Bitcoin is a tool for energy efficiency. And that is the only way forward for any civilization. This about linearly connected to energy consumption. I mean, it's not really cause and effect can be misinterpreted there. But the thing is, if we want anything to function, well, like going back to a Rousseauian caveman type scenario is not good for the environment. What happens if civilization gets more and more primitive is that human beings get more and more primitive and more barbaric as a result, and that's not good for the environment. So like, this is the big one here is to understand why Bitcoin is costly to produce, and it's precisely the point. You flipped computers and what computers do on its head. So instead of trying to be as data efficient as possible, the Bitcoin network sacrifices data to show that you've done the work. So this is what we call proof of work. And it's the consensus mechanism of Bitcoin is the thing that ensures the 21 million cap and whatever and makes Bitcoin good money. What people leave out when they talk about Bitcoin in comparison to fiat is the enormous waste of resources in fiat, because fiat also has a consensus mechanism, and that consensus mechanism is called world wars. Whoever wins a world war gets to be the world's reserve currency. Currently the dollar, and oil is priced in dollars. So like, that consensus mechanism is, in my opinion, way, 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 way worse for the environment than just using computers. Yeah, so I think I'll get into all of these things later on in the chapter. Anything you have about these first two paragraphs?
Sure. Well, I think one first thing that I'd like to touch on a little bit is that I think this is the first time we've seen the mention of the free lunch, right? This is a big theme in many of your...
Heinlein, yeah.
Yeah, many of your other books cover this quite extensively, right? Just in terms of, yeah, I think the link here to Bitcoin mining and Bitcoin energy and all this is that we don't get all of the benefits of Bitcoin without the energy cost. That's at least my interpretation of what you're getting at.
No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Proof of stake, which is some shitcoiners promote, is what we're living in now. Like the Federal Reserve System and central banking, that is a proof of stake system. Whoever sits on the money printer, that like whoever has the most resources decide, which is not the case in Bitcoin.
Definitely. And then I think some of the other points here that we're getting at is that the energy cost itself, I think we can be a little bit more direct here. There's comparisons, for example, to the banking industry. Currently, Bitcoin mining isn't even touching the energy costs of the banking industry. And then there's all the other things, such as the secondary use cases for Bitcoin, right? Like heat reuse or energizing a Kenyan village that doesn't have electricity yet or something like this, right?
Yeah, I think that comes later in these paragraphs, like something, or at least alluding to, but yeah, when you say secondary use cases, that is strictly for Bitcoin mining and miners giving off heat. We're not talking about JPEGs on the time chain here.
No, definitely not talking about that. But yeah, this link, I think, between Bitcoin's energy cost and that the savings is actually in terms of changing people's behavior, I think that's a really important thing to understand. And honestly, it's not emphasized enough. Like there are other sort of FUD busting thoughts here, right? In terms of why Bitcoin, that's what I was getting at. Like, these are the other reasons why Bitcoin mining is good. But the key idea here that Bitcoin itself is just going to incentivize people to consume less and consume more strategically and all this. And the cost is that we have to power this network that enables that. Well, it's a good trade-off in my books.
Yeah, and this is the big one. Like, changing the incentives and making Bitcoin become the standard for the world, like hyper-Bitcoinization, is the big one for the environment. Whatever environmental problem you believe we have, this is the solution, because quality over quantity, all of this low time preference, all of this civilizational advantageous stuff. Whatever comes after here is more of these superficial benefits of Bitcoin mining, like functioning as a suspension mechanism, sort of for excess energy in renewables and incentivizing renewables and stuff like that. That is all well and good, and it might be a good way to talk to normies about how Bitcoin is good for the environment and busting FUD, as you say. But the big one is the money just being completely different and getting us into this world where we have abundance without having an urge to spend. So that's the beautiful future that we envision here through Bitcoin.
Yeah, I like the last point, that there's no such thing as a low energy rich country, right? Like, we have to use energy in order to create the prosperity in the world, but that's not a bad thing. In fact, I think that's one of the closest things to an actual morality outside of any kind of religious framework that I've come to, is that it's a moral thing to increase human flourishing, and we don't do that without energy.
Absolutely not.
Okay, I think we can continue here, and you're right. I think immediately we're going to start touching on these more secondary effects, so to say. Moving on. The next time you hear about the Bitcoin network using as much energy as a small country, ask yourself, where would all that energy have ended up if it wasn't funneled into the only invention trying to save us from ourselves there is? Into a Chinese factory producing consumer goods shipped by boat, truck, and car for temporary use and probably ending up in a garbage pile the size of a small country in less than a year? How is that better for the planet? The only place from which solutions for humanity's problems can stem is human ingenuity. Such ingenuity, in turn, stems from places where people with brains have a shot at getting somewhere in life. Thanks to the internet and Bitcoin, that somewhere is everywhere. The internet connects us, and Bitcoin frees up our time and emancipates us from our current destructive systems. Bitcoin helps you plant a seed and watch it grow. Before you criticize Bitcoin, try to comprehend why it was invented and what inflationary soft money does to the mechanisms of the market. Try to understand why we have a climate problem in the first place, why we overconsume. What underlying forces pull our psychological strings and make us borrow money for a new car? It takes a special kind of ignorance to criticize a solution without fully comprehending the problem. Yeah, very good.
Yeah. So when Greta Thunberg says that, refers to fantasies of perpetual growth, that's actually true. Like, she has a point. It's just that she gets the solution completely wrong. She doesn't understand why this is a problem. And maybe growth is the incorrect word. Perpetual waste of resources is what she's getting at. And Bitcoin solves that by incentivizing people to not spend a ton of money on frivolous shit, which is what fiat does. So that, like, you can't put a square peg in a round hole, and you can't fix anything environmental without any politics that tries to solve this problem. It's just like putting a band-aid on a cancer, because, like, it's the very foundation, the money, that's the very foundation of civilization. As long as that stays unfixed, everything else is just climate cosmetics. It's just theater, and it's not is not actually addressing the underlying problem. By the way, there's a section in in the inverse of Clown World about this, where we go through like what we think about climate, the climate problem in general. And so here's the thing: like I believe that the Earth is warming. The data for that is kind of clear due to these drill things they do in the Arctic and everything. So that is not very easily questioned. That science is probably correct. That humans have caused it is highly questionable and based on models that may or may not be right. There's a bunch of other things playing into this stuff, like lunar cycles and whatnot, and solar cycles, and all sorts of things. The third point that all the environmentalists try to make us believe is that the only solution to the problem is more communism, and that can actually be pretty easily completely debunked. So like, yes, the Earth is warming. Maybe it's our fault, which I think that's just the framing of our and we and stuff is kind of dangerous. And three, like, you cannot solve it with the politics. That is just cosmetics, and it will never work. So that's the stance. Maybe that's important to clarify here before moving on. So people don't call us climate deniers or something. That's not the point. I am, though, a politics denier, 100%.
Well, I can take a shot at getting them to call us a climate denier, because I'll take everything one step further. I agree with all of your statements, but where I would take it one step further is that basically no one has sufficiently convinced me that there is anything that we should do about climate change. The thing that I acknowledge absolutely is that, yes, in the course of a changing climate generally, this might result in more extreme weather events. This pattern seems to be directionally correct. But the thing is, that's isolated. And what is the best way of isolating against, like protecting against extreme weather events? Well, that's making humanity better, making civilization better, more able to withstand this stuff. And then there's all of the other ideas that if the planet is warming on average, it's actually creating more forest. There's more greenery in the world, right? The Sahara Desert is slowly shrinking, because of all the greening that's happening, right? So if anything, and as far as I'm aware, the Antarctic ice sheet is growing also for many years in a row. Like, all of this stuff is just, there's no single thing that's happening. Yes, this might all in fact be the planet is getting warmer a little bit, really a little bit. Maybe it's caused by humans, but I don't think it's a bad thing. And at the very most we can do is live with it, I think. The alternative is go back to the Dark Ages, literally.
No, and like the biggest takeaway here is the arrogance of man. Like, I think that humanity always does this. We overestimate our own impact on things. Like, you have a medium-sized volcano will have more impact on the environment than all the aeroplanes not flying during the entirety of the stupid lockdown era. Like, the whole thing is so skewed towards like humans being important, and I think this is all throughout, like, religions, nation states, all of this stuff is just humanity having hubris and thinking we're super important. We're not that important, not as a collective anyway. Like, it's the arrogance of man.
Well, I can actually take that one step further as well, in maybe an actually controversial thing. A lot of the fiat system is built on the growth of humanity. Even Elon Musk is like basically obsessed with that humans have to proliferate. Like, we have to multiply, literally. We have to keep on increasing the human population exponentially. I don't think that's necessary at all. If the standard of living in the world is very, very good, and people end up having fewer children as a result of that. Well, like through just simply not having the burden of having no birth control and no nothing to do except make as many kids as possible, or else you might not have someone to take care of you in your old age. Like literally, human population growth is a pyramid scheme. Just in the same way that pensions are a pyramid scheme.
Yeah, I'm slight disagreement here, which I think is funny, because I think the whole FUD about population growth is also very much a product of fiat-mindedness. I think becoming the correct way to view this is that fewer people is not a problem, more people is not a problem either. Because if the more people we have, the more potential solutions to problems we have. Because the more people we are, the more likely it is for a genius to be born somewhere and solve the problem for humanity. And that happens on occasion, and that's a good thing. Like once again, the arrogance of man and the impact we had on Earth. Like I think I read this in Seyfedin's Principles of Economics, but like if you view the Earth's crust as view that as a the metaphor is a swimming pool, an Olympic sized swimming pool, then all the quarries and all the mines in the world and all the oil rigs and everything, like, can you guess how much of the Earth's crust we've dug out for resource use? It's around half a deciliter of this Olympic-sized swimming pool. So the Earth is much bigger than we think it is. And it's also why I don't buy, like, the chemtrails thing, for instance. Yeah, sure, the government might be throwing money at experiments so that some institutions might try to change the weather in from that angle. But still, that doesn't mean that every cloud in the sky is caused by humanity. That's also hubris. Like, we don't have that big of an impact. We're small. So,
I'll be clear also. I was basically along that exact line. Like, it doesn't matter the directions that the human population goes in. Anyone who's scared about either population collapse, or like when I hear about that, for example, Korea and Japan are population collapsing, therefore they need to bring in all the immigrants from the third world, and same thing with the Western countries, by the way. Like it's supposedly it's actually going to be much more dramatic. Like Korea could be a third of the size in 50 years. That's crazy. But also, what's the problem? If it weren't a literal pyramid scheme where the younger generation has to take care of the previous two generations, there wouldn't be a problem. There wouldn't be problem at all.
No, it is a problem entirely created by fiat money and inflationary currencies. Like, if people could store their value properly, the medium of exchange over time thing, then you wouldn't have to have a younger generation taking care of you. You would have sufficient amount of money to sustain yourself your entire life, especially if you did something great in your early 20s, like or made a bunch of money then. If you have number go up for the rest of your life, you can live off of that, and that's how it should be. Like we humanity gets better at stuff. Technology is inherently in deflationary, so all prices should go down at all times, and they do if you measure with the correct denominator, which is like if you view the world through a Bitcoin lens. So yeah, a long aside there, but should we get on with it?
No, it's great. And yeah, I think we're even going to touch on some more of the things we've been talking about here. So yeah, let's read the paragraph. There's one specific word that describes the current global environmentalist movement better than any other, and that word is hubris. Yes, the Earth has been getting warmer very slowly over the last 50 years. Yes, at least one of the ice caps might be melting. Yes, it's probably because of human activity, but no, you can't save the planet through political interference in people's lives. To get every nation on Earth to agree that it is a good idea to forcefully make people change their behavior for the sake of the climate is not only impossible, but also cruel and counterproductive. Collectivists always disguise their urge to deprive their fellow man of his or her possessions and freedoms as a necessary thing to do in order to save humanity. This is nothing new. They've just decided that climate change is the most effective banner to rally under right now. The causes change, but the underlying philosophy stays the same. It's very disturbing that the socialist experiment gets to repeat itself so many times in so many parts of the world. Yeah, and maybe here just the only thing to stress and emphasize is, yeah, the part about the government control.
Yeah, yeah, and I'd like to say that I've changed my views somewhat on this. I'm not at all as sure that it's humanity's quote-unquote fault anymore. Like, I'm much more of a skeptic than I was back here. We've already gone through that. So.
No, I think we have. We can move on. But did you have anything more to say about sort of like the governments have decided to make this like the mechanism for control?
No, it's always the same, right? They are FUD salesmen. Everyone in politics is a FUD salesman. They sell fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And the solution, the proposed remedy to all of these problems, supposed problems, is always more socialism. That's more state control. So that's what's so destructive about it, in my opinion. Like, it doesn't matter if it's a war on terrorism or a war on drugs or COVID policies or climate change. The solution is always the same: more state power, more centralization, and it sucks.
Yeah, I think we say plenty about that at other times, so yeah, I think we can move on now. Human progress and human flourishing have linear relationships to energy usage. If we want to find new ways of bettering ourselves, we should use more energy, not less. Truly free market competition leads to the most efficient solutions, and there are a bunch of incentives for producers of consumable goods to find cheap energy sources. Bitcoin provides the market with yet another incentive: to find locations for and invest in power plants in remote areas of the world where the cost barrier for building the plant has been too high historically due to the costly and wasteful process of transporting electricity. Hydroelectric plants in areas with a high risk of flooding, for instance. These areas are not suitable for human settlements, but they could provide us with a lot of electricity. When producers have the option to convert electricity into money directly, they're more likely to use renewable energy sources, not less. In this sense, Bitcoin can function as a battery for energy producers. Yeah, I know you have some changes in opinion on this one a little bit.
Oh, well, not really. The only thing I'm not using anymore is the Bitcoin as a battery metaphor, but that's sort of not the point of the paragraph. Like, the point is that You can put power plants in remote areas if you have a Bitcoin mining rig connected to it. Because if you compare this to like big data centers, like the data centers of the Facebooks and the Googles and the Amazons of the world, which also need a cool place with reliable energy. So they usually put those in Finland, for instance, and northern Sweden, and Canada. They put data centers because they're easy to cool there, and the energy grid is relatively stable, at least more stable than the Iberian Peninsula, apparently. But the thing with Bitcoin mining and a Bitcoin mining facility of the same size is that it doesn't need bandwidth. So all you need is like 2.5 megabytes every 10 minutes. That's a block. Like, that's the bandwidth you need. So this is what makes Bitcoin mining so different from every other, from video storage, for instance. You don't need this massive internet connection. A couple of megs every 10 minutes will suffice.
Yeah, the interesting thing here, the terminology, I agree with you. I think I come down on the side of that sometimes terminology is still useful, even if it isn't correct. And the battery thing definitely falls into that camp here. Yeah. But yeah, like the whole idea of that Bitcoin helps to incentivize this stuff. I mean, it's interesting. Finland, for example, is it's all over the news right now that Finland is adding tons of data centers specifically. That's the thing that's in the news. There's nothing about Bitcoin mining, but Bitcoin mining is happening also, a lot of it. And the thing is, the data centers, they are spending money on all of this stuff, AI, like running TikTok, whatever it is. And they are consuming the electricity, and they're doing things. They're even doing this heat reuse stuff in many cases, although some of them are too far away from the city centers to be able to do the heat reuse. But the thing is, Bitcoin mining is still a part of the picture, and it's almost invisible here. And the thing that no one gets, I think, is that the monetization is entirely different. These data centers that want to do whatever, like powering the internet, powering AI, whatever it is, they are still paying for that electricity ultimately. Bitcoin miners get paid. Bitcoin miners get paid in Bitcoin, right? And so it might be that there is some equivalency here. Bitcoin mining isn't the only thing that has sort of this battery functionality. Really, all you need is an electricity customer in order to do this. But Bitcoin mining is the perfect electricity customer because it can turn on and off at an absolute like flip of a switch, basically. These data centers can't do that. They can, but it certainly like reduces the functionality of whatever they're doing, and well, it's monetized. Bitcoin mining pays for itself. Maybe not literally, but it does though. You get the Bitcoin, so that's pretty great.
Yeah, and even if it's not entirely self-sustaining because the electricity price is too high, like. You're still, if you're the energy company, you might see things differently. So like, just to flesh out how this works in practice. So like, energy on the earth is abundant. What is not abundant is a specific amount of energy at a specific point in time and space. So like, energy directed somewhere. And this is also why, like, batteries can store energy for a while, but they're not very efficient at storing energy, and it doesn't last forever. So it's very hard to, and the energy used in manufacturing the battery is often higher than the whatever the battery can store and stuff like that. So a renewable site like a wind farm or a bunch of solar panels. The thing with them is that they don't provide this reliable, steady source of energy, like a nuclear power plant or even a hydroelectric plant. What they produce is that they sometimes underproduce and they sometimes overproduce energy. If there's no wind, there is no energy from the wind farm. If there's too much wind, right now they have to put on the brakes and make them stop and tilt the wings so that they don't destroy the turbine. But that does not have to be the case. If you have Bitcoin miners connected to the wind farm, then when they overproduce, the excess energy that would otherwise have been wasted can just go into the Bitcoin miner. And the same is for flaring natural gas, for instance. That can also be done. Same with solar panels. But this is the thinking in small terms. So like, yeah, whenever we're overproducing, we can use it for Bitcoin mining. But imagine instead that the main purpose of the wind farm was to produce Bitcoins, or to produce block space rather, like to be a Bitcoin miner and get paid in Bitcoin for producing block space. Then like whenever there was a shortage of energy in the human settlement close to the wind farm, then they could cut some of the Bitcoin mining to provide them with energy. So the load, the big part of the load could be the Bitcoin mining. And like this rewrites everything, every theory around like these renewable energy sources, because they will function in a completely different way in the future, where every energy company is a Bitcoin mining company, first and foremost. And I think we're going in that direction, whether people see it or not doesn't matter, because like all the incentives are aligned for that to happen. The only thing stopping it is political interventionism, as usual. But I think it's a very elegant solution, like a completely out of the box solution to everything here. And it might finally solve all the energy problems, given enough time.
Oh, this is just great. I mean, I love learning about Bitcoin mining and everything that's going on with the industry. It's really a fantastic merging of kind of the so-called normie industrial system, energy production, and all of these other ways that Bitcoin mining can get involved. Like it is actually a way in for many who have no other reason to get into Bitcoin. It's a perfect conduit, a perfect parallel. So I love seeing it. No, that was a great explanation. I don't have anything more specifically to add here. Just that the Bitcoin mining's use case is load balancing. I mean, we've heard people say, on our show and elsewhere, like a Bitcoin mine is going to be everywhere in every house, like heating it, whatever it is. Bitcoin mining isn't going anywhere, and it's in fact going everywhere, and that's pretty great.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on here. Offshore wind farms have a very specific wind force range where they produce a usable amount of electricity. The bigger the turbine, the wider the range, but they still have an upper and lower wind force limit. If an offshore wind farm had been connected to a Bitcoin mining rig, the surplus energy produced on windy days could have been converted into a profit for the producer instantly. The same logic applies to solar farms and geothermal plants. Energy is not a finite resource in any practical sense for the inhabitants of Mother Earth. If we could harness and store all the power of all the sunlight that hits the Earth during just one day, we could satisfy all of humanity's energy needs for a couple of hundred years. Bitcoin's role in all of this is unexplored, but its potential to be a very positive environmental force is huge, and it will prove its utility during the next century. On one hand, it provides energy producers with a battery. On the other hand, it gives central bankers a run for their money and ultimately forces them to adopt a more sound monetary policy or become obsolete altogether. Bitcoin creates an incentive for sacrificing surplus energy for a small profit and a greater good rather than just letting it go to waste. The energy harnessed is converted into a completely scarce asset that is divisible and transportable to a much greater extent than any other valuable resource on Earth. It incentivizes energy producers to think long-term and will reward those most patient and least wasteful among them. This recalibration of incentive structures is, of course, not only limited to energy producers or miners, but to anyone who embraces this technology and understands its implications. In due time, Bitcoin's superior monetary properties will be undeniable even to the most stubborn dinosaur. This would be an enormous net gain for humanity and the environment. Yeah, so the merging of the two approaches, basically, what Bitcoin literally does in terms of energy production, the connection to that, but also the incentive changes.
Yeah, and back to the incentive changes, that's the big one. Like all of this other stuff, Bitcoin as a battery for energy companies is all well and good, and it's just going to change the world. But the thing that's going to change the world even more is this quality over quantity mindset that Bitcoin incentivizes. Sound money fixes everything.
Sound money fixes everything. Let's continue to explore.
Yeah, I think so. Since we explored the ideas quite thoroughly here a couple of paragraphs back, so let's just get on,
Jay. Yeah, I think we have. I think we have a tendency actually to do this. We know what's in the chapter generally, but then it's we just talk about all the things before we get to the actual paragraphs. Yeah.
Yeah, and the paragraphs are sort of leading up to the next thought, and then you express that thought, and then it's actually in the next paragraph. So
yeah, it's okay. Let's continue. Courageous politicians dare to implement unpopular policies. They don't need climate-striking teenagers to tell them which issues ought to be addressed first. It is ironic how celebrities who score cheap points by talking about the climate often accuse their political opponents of being populist. What really happens when you raise carbon taxes and try to force populations into behaviors they don't really like? The Gilets Jaunes, or yellow vests, in France are a great example. People still have to commute to work. Raising taxes solves nothing. It just distorts the market and relocates the problem. The only thing the recently adopted environmentalist policies of France resulted in was the destruction of Paris, arguably not the best thing for the environment. In a truly free society, a society with sound money, climate-striking children wouldn't be a problem. They would have to learn to cooperate in order to address whatever imaginary problem they sought to solve, which would be harmless to the rest of us. Now, when backed by fear-mongering journalists, they can cause a ton of damage, as our virtue-signaling political class needs to adapt to whatever imaginary issue the press has primed us with in order to secure votes. It's not about whether there is a real climate problem or not, but rather about motives. Always ask yourself, what does this person stand to gain from holding this particular opinion? Can this issue really be solved by political means? Okay.
Yeah. The Gilets Jaunes that was the current thing in 2019, and it's interesting to watch France unfold. Like, 6 years have passed, and France is still a hellhole, in my opinion, and overtaxed everywhere, and not really. These riots in Paris are still happening, France during the lockdowns was a horrible place. I drove through it, and even that was hard. I don't know. What to say about this? The whole thing is back to, you know, politicians not being able to solve anything, really. And the media and the politics being in cahoots, driving forward all of these narratives. That it's all FUD mongering, selling fear to people and a proposed solution, which is always more money for them, more power for them.
Well, and I have a continuing point here a little bit, and what I'd like to focus on a bit is that it's children, climate striking children. Yeah. The most perverse part about Greta Thunberg is basically that there's some idea that the children have to tell the adults what's up, and that children have the responsibility of solving the world's problems because they're the ones who are going to be there in the future. And that's so backwards. I know on this show, we basically would advocate for getting rid of the state and voting and all this altogether. But I think one of the short-term ways to solve many of the world's problems is to basically raise the voting age to something like 30. Because the thing is, when kids just don't have an understanding of the world, they haven't gotten enough life experience to basically just be able to chill and understand that the world isn't falling to pieces with every little thing, and that there is such a thing as nuance. Like, just waiting for people to mature a little longer would make it so that people have a much lower time preference. Like, kids have no concept of, like, needing to make their own money in order to live, and just see things in terms of black and white, right? Like, one of the biggest things that Jordan Peterson helped me with a little bit here was the whole idea of that don't criticize the world until you've sorted yourself out, basically. And that, I think, is one of the best pieces of advice. And if more young people could actually understand that, that would be really good. Like, don't be plugged into the media machine. Don't be plugged into social media and getting all worried about every little thing that's going on. Just work on being the best person you can be, whatever that looks like. And you know what? Your world is going to be so much better because of it. And even if you are scared about something that's happening in the world, like, what can you do about it? And I think the only true answer is just to be the best person you can be and to do what you can in your world. Eventually, that's going to start expanding. The ways you can make an impact on the world will only increase. And if something you care about is still wrong in the world, maybe in the future you'll have some resources to be able to tackle that problem somehow. But just whining about it like a kid is just ridiculous. Giving the kids more power, reducing the voting age to 16. Like, why don't we just reduce the voting age to 5? Like, come on. Like, it's such a farce. But at least I think if raising the voting age to 30 would really make democracy much less of a total stupid shit show.
Yeah, it would still be a shit show, but a less stupid one. I think, though, that the history of this is that the left has always been pro younger and younger people voting, because it was kind of reliable that the youth would vote more left in the past. But that trend seems to be shifting. Like, the youth of today's votes more right wing than ever before. which is positive, of course. I think that has something to do with information being more accessible, and you know, the podcasting revolution, people abandoning mainstream media, state-funded media for private outlets, simply because they can, and of course that leads to better results. So while we still have all the inherent problems with democracy, at least like it's the Jurassic Park quote, like life finds a way. If the truth can get out there, then things will get better slowly but surely. And I think this Greta Thunberg is probably a phenomenon that could only have happened right then and there. Like, I don't think she would have been at all as effective today, because I think people would see through it for what it was earlier. And that the left has sort of abandoned this youth narrative because they can't get the votes there any longer.
Yeah, very good point. I think we'll continue on this line. So, yeah, on to the next one. There's no such thing as a free lunch. There is such a thing as representation, however, and there's always a personal economic motive behind political decisions. They're not here for you, you're here for them. One of the most eye-opening experiences of my life was seeing the lobbyist quarters in Brussels. The rise of veganism, placebic gluten intolerance, and meat-free Mondays in school cafeterias are all products of the food industry. A soy burger is a lot cheaper to produce than a beef one. To anyone who can sell it at a higher price by appealing to people's vanity or world-saving hubris, huge profits await. They've managed to monetize our collective bad climate conscience in such a cunning way that most of us have no clue we're being played. In the 20th century, the serial killers of the Kellogg's Company and their likes funded research that cemented a fear of red meats and saturated fats into the minds of the public. The effects of this propaganda can very much still be seen today, as the inhabitants of America are about twice as fat today than they were before the introduction of light products to the market. All of these things are connected to the root of the problem, the lack of sound money. Inflation made it possible for the food industry to replace our homemade beef burger with a mass-produced cheap soy substitute, while making us believe that the price of a burger hadn't changed that much in the last 50 years. Spoiler alert, it had. Another of the most eye-opening experiences I've had was during my stay in a Mayan village in the Toledo district of Belize about 10 years ago. I spent a couple of days with a family of two adults and six children in a jungle village of huts and no electricity save for two diesel generators. One night, the father of the house told me a story about his friend going into politics a decade earlier and being murdered for having the wrong opinions. We slept on wooden beds without mattresses, and a couple of dogs and turkeys ran freely around the village. One day, the family's 10-year-old was listening to some Bob Marley songs on a CD player connected to a car battery and a small solar panel on a pole in the garden. I listened for a while and then asked him about the strange sound effects in between the songs. Helicopter sounds, machine gun sounds, and other strange noises were intersecting the songs here and there. He replied by telling me, "Oh, it's not a proper CD. I made it with Virtual DJ on my cousin's laptop." I was stunned. Here was this 10-year-old, in the middle of the jungle, just as skilled with a computer as any other 10-year-old I had ever met. At that moment, I realized just how leveled the playing field has been for the workforce across the globe. Here was this child living in a hut without even electricity, but also without a mortgage to inherit, ready to compete on the same global market as any kid in the world. Bitcoin is the logical next step. Bitcoin doesn't care about nationality, gender, ethnicity, age, sexual preferences, or any other imagined victimization or privilege. To Bitcoin, we are all equal. It is a voluntary system and it knows no biases. Bitcoin is equality of opportunity in its purest form, and it doesn't have any opinion on the outcome whatsoever. Yeah, a bit of a long one here, but it all flowed into each other, and I think the final point is a good tie together for this chapter.
Yeah. There is no free lunch, there is no second breakfast, but there is such a thing as representation, and that's a key point here. Everyone can be bought. Like, it's very easy to buy a politician. is you can buy a scientist to you can bribe people to say the things you want. Once you're in Bitcoin, and if you're a public Bitcoiner, you get to experience being offered bags of shitcoiner money on an almost daily basis. And this is, of course, this goes on in fiat land too. Fiat crypto is basically just the extension of fiat. It's late stage fiat. So I am absolutely 100% certain that most politicians are corrupt. Like the system rewards corruption. You buy someone dinner, you befriend someone, you and then you motivate them to write into law legislations that favor you over others. That's how the whole machinery works. Lobbyism is nothing but corruption. That's what it is. It's buying yourself privileges from powerful people. And the only solution is to remove the entire tumor. Like, band-aids don't work here. We need to get rid of the tumor. And the tumor is first and foremost the monetary system and central banking, because it enables all of the other stuff. It's much easier, like, for politicians today than 100 years ago. In comparison, like, the relative size of the state compared to 100 years ago is enormous today. Because they've not only have the taxes increased, but they've also used the monetary spigot to enrich themselves, and it's horrible, and it needs to be fixed. And the only way to fix it is what Friedrich Hayek called a sly roundabout way, introducing something that they cannot stop. And that is what Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is Hayek's sly roundabout way. It is the solution. And it is also, like I say in this last paragraph, it is the equality of opportunity materialized. That's what it is. It's rules without rulers. That means we're all equal towards the law here. This kind of law, the rules without rulers law, voluntary law, natural law, like not opinionated, not corrupt, not bribes cannot do anything here. So, yeah. Bitcoin is hope.
Bitcoin is hope. Yeah, absolutely. And well, I mean, I think the only thing I'd like to echo here is that, yeah, like the system right now of politics is really just trying to change the world in whatever means possible. Being the one to be allowed to make the most changes you can for some reason and probably get enriched through the process. Like politics is really... Yeah, I'm really jaded by the whole thing, as you can tell, I'm sure. But yeah,
you escaped Canada because of it.
Well, exactly. Yeah, and equality of opportunity. I mean, even that is sort of a fallacy. It's like no one is ever going to have exactly the same opportunity, but at least the distortions of the monetary system aren't going to be what's in the way. I think that's the key point here. And if the world can just get over that, we're not going to have the same outcome. That would be good, because we're not all going to have the same outcome. If we can directionally aim towards a world where everyone on average is better off, which has been happening for hundreds of years, or maybe even longer, if we really, really go back, maybe there have been hiccups, but humanity has been trending in the right direction for a while. It's good. It's good. Some people are going to fall through the cracks, and that's unfortunate. And it would be nice if we could also enable a society where people are more able to help their neighbor or help their family themselves so they don't need help. So you can get over like a small bump in the road. The only difference is not relying on the government to provide that for you. It takes away the dependence and everyone is going to flourish more. So, Bitcoin is the solution to all of this. And the connection to energy and to the environment, it's all one complex package here. The environmental stuff and the energy stuff, it's all intertwined with Bitcoin. It's only one facet, though, of what Bitcoin fixes. Bitcoin fixes such a bigger thing. But it's a great point that Bitcoin basically is going to do what the environmentalists have wanted to do just by changing people's behavior. And by removing the ability for people who want to have power over others to be able to do it so easily. Those things are the powerful things.
Exactly. And when I say equality of opportunity here, I don't mean like tax everyone to oblivion when they die so that the children have started zero. It's opportunity in that everyone should be equal in terms of the law. That's the bias that needs to be removed.
I think this has been a good summary of the chapter. Very good one. Very interesting one. A little different from much of the other content, but yeah, basically touching on some of the biggest issues that people point to as why Bitcoin is bad is all the energy use. But really, it's the energy use is a good thing, and the effects that Bitcoin has on the world is definitely a good thing. Anything else in summary?
No, I think that perfectly sums it up. It's all connected. There is no such thing as a circular economy. Everything is connected. There is no money in circulation. It belongs to someone. There is no such thing as a free lunch, and there is no such thing as a second breakfast. And with that, I think we can tell our listeners a bit about our sponsors, like the Plan B Network, for instance. You should go to planb.network to find all sorts of interesting courses on Bitcoin and adjacent topics. The Plan B Business School for this year is full on at the moment, and I'm going to Lugano to guest lecture here in about a month or a little less than a month to talk about praxeology. There are a whole bunch of other great guest lecturers, and Giacomo Soko is the head teacher of that course. The course from last year is free, but if you want to join this year, I think you still can, and you can just catch up with the lessons you've missed. And it's a great initiative. They're expanding to El Salvador and Taiwan and all sorts of places. So yeah, Japan. So I'm really excited to be a part of that, or we are really excited to be a part of that, and looking forward to collaborating with Plan B even more in the future. Great stuff.
Yeah, Plan B is fantastic, and this is just the perfect fit for us to be working with them. Our stuff might be a little bit deeper, but definitely I would say point your Bitcoin curious people towards Plan B. Go there yourself, because there's just so many great stuff that you can do to deepen your understanding of Bitcoin through there. We take our own lens, but they're certainly quite direct about it. So that's just really fantastic. And of course, our other sponsor is Bitbox. They're our favorite hardware wallet, and they're really just the top of the game here. They don't compromise on security, but they keep everything easy to use. Your grandma can use a Bitbox, and that's kind of the point. Is they make self-custody of your Bitcoin an absolutely no-brainer and easy thing to do. And they have lots of other cool stuff on their website that's related to the whole hardware wallet thing, and they're always just doing really good stuff to support the communities, especially in the European region. They're Swiss, so they do a lot of stuff in the German and Italian communities of it. But we're glad to be a part of the Bitbox community, and wholeheartedly recommend you go check out bitbox.swiss/infinity, and then make sure to get the Bitcoin only firmware, because that's all you need.
Yes, it looks like this, like a USB stick, so it's very sneaky.
Absolutely. Knut, anything else you want to touch on before we wrap up for today?
Not really. I think this was a good episode. Looking forward to doing the next one. Yeah. Take care, everyone.
Take care. Thank you. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Thanks for listening.